Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Scott Harrington, and I'm here today to talk to you about glucose monitoring. Yes, you may know me. I'm the doctor at Vegan Primary Care. I have patients can see me online and in person. I'm currently in 16 states where we can see each other through telemedicine. I can order labs and send referrals and be your primary care doctor. If you live in Florida, in Pinellas Park, Florida, near St. Petersburg, I can see you in person. Here are the 16 states that I am in, and I accept insurance, Cigna, Aetna, TRICARE, and Medicare. So today we're going to talk about glucose monitoring. Why did I choose this topic? Well, I get a lot of patients that ask me about their blood sugar and about maybe throughout the years they've seen their hemoglobin A1C rising and all the way up into the pre-diabetic level. Even when they're vegan, sometimes this happens. And so we want to start putting the focus on their glucose. And so, and also glucometers are very popular right now. You hear about a lot about it. A lot of third parties are using these glucometers in various apps. And let's say you're already on a plant-based diet and you're doing everything you can for your health, but you're still struggling with weight or with relatively high blood sugars. I deal with this due to my family history of diabetes, and I deal with rising blood sugars even though I'm living a very healthy life. So I'm very interested in this topic as well. Okay, so first thing we have to know about is about insulin and glucose. So the pancreas produces insulin, and glucose is in the blood, and it has to get into the cell. And the way it gets into the cell is with insulin. So back up here, we have the insulin receptor is like a key, and insulin is like the key, and the insulin receptor is like a keyhole, and then the glucose transporter, and that's what opens up. That's like the door that opens up for glucose. So the pancreas produces insulin, and glucose is in your blood, and normally you have insulin will attach to the insulin receptor, and it will open up the door for glucose to go into the cell. This is normal physiology. So you've heard about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. What happens in type 1? In type 1 diabetes, the pancreas is not producing enough insulin. So there's not enough insulin hanging around to allow the glucose to get into the cell through the glucose transporter. So that is blocked. In type 1, even if you eat very healthily, you have to take insulin. You have to inject insulin because you just don't have it. But the goal is to eat a very healthy diet, very low-fat, plant-based diet, so that you don't require a lot of insulin. You can use the least amount of insulin as possible. So this is type 1. So most people are dealing with type 2. And what happens with type 2? Type 2 is where you have insulin. You can see the insulin here inside the insulin receptor, but it doesn't seem to have the effect of opening the door, opening the glucose transporter. And so glucose builds up. We used to think this was just because people were eating high sugar all the time and that your insulin receptor got sort of immune to the insulin, or it got used to it. It was like tolerant to insulin. But what we've now learned is that by having fat in your diet, fat in your tissues, intracellular fat, it messes up the signaling. It messes up the signaling from the insulin receptor to tell the glucose transporter to open up. So within the cell, it's not getting the message. It's not getting the message to open the door. Even if you have high insulin levels. So this is type 2. This is insulin resistance. So here is an example of glucose monitoring and an example of showing how glucose would be higher for longer in someone who has type 2 diabetes versus someone who has normal physiology. So you can see in the blue line where in after about 1 hour, your blood sugar goes up and then it starts rapidly coming back down to your baseline. So at 2 hours, they're already at the baseline. Whereas the someone with diabetes, one, they have a higher baseline, and two, it takes much longer for them to get back down to normal because they have insulin resistance. So Normally, in our community, we're listening to Chef AJ. We're learning about calorie density and staying below the calorie density line, the 600 calories per pound line. And this is a way to lose weight and eat a healthy diet and stay full because low calorie density and high bulk. This is a way to do it without counting calories or counting carbs and all of this. And this is the sort of approved solution. This is the gold standard, I would say, for how to lose weight in a very simple way without having to think too much about it, just as long as you stay with these low carb, or I'm sorry, high bulk, high fiber, and overall low calorie foods. This is the goal. But if you are having problems with sugar and you're monitoring your sugar and you're seeing that you're having high spikes, then you can eat within the same diet and you could try to improve your blood sugar. So there are some information that you need to know. One, you need to know about the glycemic index. Foods that are whole tend to have a low glycemic index, and this is the rate at which blood sugar gets entered into your bloodstream. Glycemic index. How fast does it cause a sugar spike? And so this is all compared to glucose. Glucose or straight sugar that is causing a quick spike. Everything would be compared to that. So as you can see, glucose here is all the way at 100, and cornflakes are still very high, over 80. Crackers very high, so all the fiber has been removed. White bread, even white rice. Things that are much lower are lentils or non-starchy vegetables. Broccoli, you can see, is very low. So here's an example. Things in the low glycemic category: carrots, raw carrots, broccoli, lentils, for instance. But there's another concern. There is another concern because fruit tends to be relatively high on the glycemic index, but we know that fruit is healthy. So there is another concept here, and the concept is glycemic load. And glycemic load is basically how many carbs are in your food. How many carbs? So it's not just about the glycemic index. For instance, here we have a chocolate bar, which I don't recommend, but what we're saying here is that it has a kind of a low glycemic index. Maybe it's the fat, maybe it's the nuts that's slowing down the absorption of the sugar, I guess, making it have like a slower sugar spike. However, there is a lot of sugar, a lot of carbs in one of these Snickers bar type foods. 59 grams of sugar and carbs versus the watermelon here. In 100 grams, you'd have 8 grams of carbs, even though the glycemic index is high. So, what would be the overall effect on your blood sugar? And so, really, it's about glycemic load. So, glycemic load, for instance, for the Snickers bar would be 20 high, 25 versus 5 for the watermelon. So, why are we even worried about all of this? Well, spikes in blood sugar are problematic. Spikes in blood sugar can be associated with vascular damage over time. That's the reason why diabetics, we're worried about treating diabetics, we're worried about the vascular damage that occurs in the eyes and the kidneys, causing increased rates of heart attacks and stroke. We're worried about fatty liver, damage to the liver, and we're also worried about weight gain. And so, this little cryptic slide here, right here, where the bell curve there is various hemoglobin A1C levels for patients. And the line that you see going across is mortality. So the higher, this one is all compared to five, a hemoglobin A1C of five. But each notch that you go higher from hemoglobin A1C of five, it shows an increased mortality. So what is diabetes? Diabetes is defined as a hemoglobin A1C of 6.5. And we'll talk about hemoglobin A1C. But if you prick your finger and you test the fasting glucose, if you have a fasting glucose of 126 or over, that's considered diabetes. If you have a random glucose, basically a fed glucose of over 200, that's considered diabetes. Or if you do a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, this is where you go to the lab and they give you a very specific sugar drink that has 75 grams of glucose dissolved in solution, and you drink it on an empty stomach, and then they test 2 hours later and they find that you're 200, then you're positive for diabetes. So, but it's not just about this. It's also the idea of sugar spikes, because ideally we would blunt the sugar spikes. And that's one of the reasons why we could try to use a glucose monitor. So here's hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is a pretty good test because it's a 90-day average. And we might find that our glucose kind of goes up and down if we're stressed, or if we didn't get enough sleep that night, you can have excursions of the blood sugar. And it's hard to have this. There's less variability in a hemoglobin A1C, and that's because a hemoglobin A1C is based on the lifespan of a red blood cell. The hemoglobin has a glucose that attaches to it, and the more glucose that attaches to it, it's related to the higher the blood sugar. So, for instance, if your hemoglobin A1C is 5.5%. Then that would equal a average 90-day average of 110 blood sugar. Whereas if it was 145 blood sugar, that would equal a 6.5% on the hemoglobin A1C. Now, hemoglobin A1C is really good. It's my favorite blood sugar test. However, sometimes you have false positives or kind of false negatives with hemoglobin A1C. And that's things that can turn over the that can have slow the turnover of your blood cells, then you can have a falsely elevated hemoglobin A1C, like iron deficiency, B12 deficiency, or chronic kidney disease. And even it can be different among races. It can have some changes, and then in terms of high turnover states like pregnancy, if you have chronic liver disease and various things that are causing loss of your red blood cells, blood loss, then you're going to have a high turnover rate, and so you're going to have less of your blood cells affected by the blood sugar. So this is going to cause you to have an inaccurate hemoglobin A1C. So you may want to test yourself. You may want to find out what your own fasting blood sugar is, and so you can get a glucometer. I recommend the Contour Next or Next brands. And I mean, I know it was a long time ago now, but 2017, they compared 17 point of care testers, these glucometers, and Contour Next came out on the most accurate form of the point of care glucometer tests. And so, but this is kind of a pain. You know, you prick your finger and you get your blood and you put it on the meter and you get it and you get a one-time reading. But this is a way that you can test your fasting blood sugar. And remember, a 126 is considered the cutoff for diabetes. Or you could check your blood sugar, and if it's ever over 200, that would be highly concerning for diabetes. So what about these continuous glucose monitors? These are really popular right now. You'll hear a lot about them. There's two leading brands right now, FreeStyle Libre 3 and Dexcom G7. They come with apps and they Bluetooth. You wear them. For the FreeStyle Libre is 2 weeks and the Dexcom is 10 days. And you wear them and they have these apps. The FreeStyle Libre, 1 month supply, they're expensive. 1 month supply is 130 to 153 using a GoodRx coupon. It has to be prescribed these things to the pharmacy. Dexcom G7, it lasts 10 days. And so you would get three sensors for a 1 month supply at 177 to 196, depending on which pharmacy you go, using one of those coupons. So they are expensive, but they are kind of fun because you can see what your blood sugar is doing. You can see the trends. In terms of why should you not use one of these glucometers? Well, in non-diabetics, they're important for diabetics because you're trying to control your blood sugar. You might be taking medicines. You might be taking insulin, but the trend now is for people who are non-diabetic to be on glucometers. And so what's the point there? They can cause you to have anxiety. Every time you see a sugar spike, you're worried about the effects that it's having on your body. The one of the downsides is that they're not as accurate as the point of care glucometer testing. So this is kind of problematic. You wouldn't want to do treatment decisions if you were diabetic unless you do the point of care tests. Kind of the important part about them is the trends that they offer you. You can see when you're stressed, you can see when you're snacking and stuff, how you're increasing your blood sugar. But another problem with them is the fact that they may alarm in the middle of the night. So if you're wearing a glucometer on your arm and you roll over on it in the middle of the night, the blood and the interstitial tissue that interstitial blood, I'm sorry, interstitial fluid that is that the sensor is picking up is being pushed away from the sensor. So at night you can get alarms and it can say that you're too low, but it might be a false reading. So you would want to have a glucometer so you could check the accuracy of that and understand whether that was a false alarm or not. But that is a very common complaint. Another thing is I'm usually recommending people expand their palate and eat lots of plant-based foods and try lots of things. And one of the concerns is people may get in the habit of seeing something and removing it from their diet because of the sugar spike that it created. And so this is something where people all of a sudden start having a constricted palate, and they're always feeling like it's a minefield every time you eat. They can be expensive, so we went over that too. So these are the cons of a continuous glucose monitor. So what are the benefits? Well, the benefits are that if your blood sugar is rising, your hemoglobin A1C is going up and up and up, and you've tried various things, changing your diet, getting out the processed food, getting out, carbs that have had their fiber removed from it, like bread, for instance, or obviously pastries or chips, the high glycemic index carbs. But some people want to use this as a training device or a way to almost gamify the way they eat or get immediate feedback. It can help you learn what works for you. And you can see how it can be a lifestyle training tool, because you can see that when you have extra stress, or if you are snacking all the time, that you're going to have average, on average, you're going to have higher blood sugar because your blood sugar goes up and it's less likely to be at the baseline. By knowing that you're monitored can kind of keep you from doing the self-forgetting thing, like, oh, no one's going to know, I'm just going to have a snack or something like that. And then one of the big learning things from having a continuous glucose monitor is that you'll see that throughout the day, the blood sugar gets worse and worse. Even within the same, if you have a meal that is the same calories, it gets higher and higher. So these are some of the benefits. It can be a learning tool that you use temporarily. I mean, if you don't have diabetes, you don't have to continuously monitor all the time. But it could be a chance to do a learning experiment for you and to see how your blood sugar reacts. So, what about for weight loss? Well, this has been validated. This has been validated by several studies that show that people can use these glucometers as weight loss tools. And how do they do it? How do they do it? Well, one of the things is trying to do learning how you feel versus how your blood sugar is. And one of the things that you always hear people say is like, oh man, my blood sugar must be really low. I'm really, hungry, or I'm not really feeling up to the task right now because I'm hungry. And they might feel kind of emotional. Well, I've worn these glucometers for, I've had access to these glucometers. And one of the things that I found is that my emotions and my hunger may not be associated with the actual blood sugar number. That might actually not be low. I might not be back at my baseline, my fasted baseline of blood sugar. So being able to kind of start to learn what your hungers are, your hunger cues when you get back down to baseline is valuable, definitely. So many times we might be eating outside of our hunger. We might be trying to self-soothe, or we might be eating just because it's lunchtime. And so by doing this, we're always keeping ourselves in a overfed state. And so one of the things that has been suggested is this topic called hunger training, or also known as glucose-guided eating. And through by doing this, studies have shown that you can decrease your weight by basically waiting until you're back down to your baseline and you're also hungry. This is kind of a similar thing to intermittent fasting, but it's just waiting till you're hungry to eat and then checking your blood sugar, making sure it's not elevated from your baseline. Well, some of the things that are learned from wearing a continuous glucose monitor is that, once again, your glucose tolerance seems to get worse as the day goes on. So at nighttime, there's other factors that are at play. So we were evolved in a normal circadian rhythm, so there's a night and a day, and there are functions that happen at night. We have a little bit of pancreatic dysfunction at night, or it kind of slows down at night in terms of insulin production. Also, we have other hormones like growth hormone that may sort of counteract insulin's effects. And then you have glucagon release from the liver, which causes blood sugar to go up a little bit. So there are some things at night that make it late night eating even more problematic for your overall blood sugar. So we know that identical meals, like I was saying before, throughout the day can cause taller and wider spikes of blood sugar. So same meal, higher spikes and longer lasting. They call this the area under the curve. The spike, if it's a narrow, skinny spike and it comes back down really fast, that's a low amount of area under the curve. And wider, taller spikes, higher area under the curve. This correlates with vascular damage. So we want our spikes to be narrow and back down. Okay. Stress plays a big role. Here is a screenshot from Freestyle Libra. This was mine on one of the days where I was driving home from work, and there was a people were stopping, and there was a lot of traffic, and suddenly stopping, and there were accidents, and I was experiencing some stress, and I had a 40-point increase. I was wearing one of these glucose monitors, and I had a 40-point increase just during my drive, and I wasn't eating. I was in a fasted state. So stress can play a big role. I've heard of people even watching a movie. They're watching a movie, and it's really a hectic or stressful or suspenseful movie, and their adrenaline is being released, and your blood sugar is going up. So a lot of factors, a lot of things can affect your blood sugar, and this kind of goes to show that we should be learning about stress reduction techniques to help us not be on this sort of glucose roller coaster. Snacking raises your blood sugar. I know this is a no-brainer, but a lot of times we go throughout the day and we might say to ourselves, "Oh, I need a snack," or "I need a little pick-me-up." But ideally, you want to wait to keep your blood sugar at baseline, especially if you're trying to lose weight. If you're not trying to lose weight, or if you're underweight, for instance, you have got free game. There's no holds barred. You can eat when you're hungry, obviously. But if you're trying to lose weight, you don't want to be snacking because you want to increase the time you have on that baseline where the body can start to decide to eat some of its fat or break down some fat, so the energy reserves. Okay. Here is just a crude example of some three aspects of continuous glucose monitoring. So on one side, you have a healthy meal, healthy meal where you have at your baseline, you eat a meal and then you have an excursion. The blood sugar is starting to go up. And then, you know, right about by the 2 hour mark, it's down almost to your baseline again. So this would be ideal. You have maybe a 30 point excursion. This is a really good meal. So this is a meal that's probably loaded with vegetables. Maybe it is a salad. Maybe it has some beans, some high fiber. Maybe if you're eating sort of more of a high carb type of food, it is in whole form, whether it's a whole potatoes or whole grain, such as, you know, farro or oat groats or something like this, quinoa, high in fiber. And it just gets right back down to normal and you have a small excursion. So that's this. Now let's say that the carb portion that you're eating is really glycemic and you have the fiber has been removed and you don't have a lot of other food in the meal that contains a lot of roughage and fiber, maybe not a lot of phytonutrients, other nutrients, or amylase inhibitors like berries where they slow down the blood sugar release. So if you're eating one of these like kind of white meals that are processed and have the fiber taken away, you might get a quick excursion or a high excursion, 45 points or more. And then if you haven't had a lot of fat in the meal, it might still come back pretty relatively quickly and you don't have diabetes, you might come bring it down really quickly. But this is a little bit more problematic, and you can see that with the high excursion, that's a little bit more problematic because it goes into the red line. It's doing a little bit more damage to your vascular tissue. And then on the far right, you've got high carbs or high carb load, same thing. So glycemic load is really high. So a big meal, maybe large meal with a lot of carbs, plus kind of high in fat, that kind of slows things down and makes you mildly insulin resistant. And you can get a longer peak, longer spike, wider spike. So clearly the area under the curve on this one is going to be much higher than the area under the curve of these healthy meals. So what is hunger training? Hunger training is when you only eat when you're hungry and your blood sugar is under your baseline. Well, how do you figure out your baseline? Baseline is ideally it's when your fasted state. So when you wake up over the last two mornings, an average of your last two mornings waking blood sugar. So if you would wait till you get a little bit underneath this baseline, once you start to creep under the baseline, you would have a meal, and as well, you'd wait till you're hungry. Now, this is not a good idea just to wait all day. Like if you're a pre-diabetic and you have mild insulin resistance, this doesn't mean that you should wait all day to eat. This is when you're doing this hunger training business, you could try to wait till you get underneath your baseline. So where can you find information about this hunger training and this glucose monitoring stuff? Here are two folks that I have paid attention to who've done good work with this glucose monitoring. And one is our well-known Mastering Diabetes group, Cyrus Kambada and Robbie Barbaro. And then also someone that I heard on Veggie Doctor Radio, I heard it was Marty Kendall with Optimizing Nutrition. And I'm learning about what Marty teaches, and he teaches all about this hunger training. And so very interesting stuff. And you could check him out. He has a website, Optimizing Nutrition. He's not necessarily plant-based. He's agnostic to that, but he has, so he has people that are following Optimizing Nutrition that are eat omnivore diets and plant-based diets and all sorts of diets. But he teaches about the glucose monitoring as well. Okay. One of the things that, you know, we said where there was cons and there was benefits and cons. And I think that with the benefit of this continuous glucose monitoring is about course correction, not about perfection. Because every time you eat, you're going to have an excursion of your blood sugar. And this gets way more complicated than simply eating, you know, 600 calories per pound food and we can really get worried and we can really get anxious about it. And so this would just be a temporary sort of check on how you're doing and a temporary learning experience of how to try to eat in a way that's a little bit of a less of a metabolic emergency for your body. A little bit, it'll teach you to eat a little higher in fiber, a little lower in processed foods, and seeing it on seeing the numbers and seeing how you react. And so once again, this is about course correction, not perfection, because nobody's perfect, and you're always going to have some excursion of the blood sugar. All right, so I have had questions a lot about Ozempic. And when I asked Chef AJ, what, you know, are we getting a lot of questions? And she says she's getting a lot of questions about these magic medicines, Ozempic, Wegovy, which is semaglutide, and Mounjaro and Zepbound, which is tirzepatide. Now, she says she's getting lots of questions about this, and she wants to know what my opinion and what I recommend about these types of medications. And so let's go over it. These medicines mimic our own gut hormones called incretins. And when you compare these to weight loss medications from the past, like stimulant medicines, phentermine, which is kind of adjacent to something like meth or something, where it stimulates you, your body, and tries to decrease your appetite. That's not good. It could raise your blood pressure and be real problematic. Well, there was the fat blockers like orlistat and these kind of things. Well, these would cause changes in your bowels and greasy stool that could cause accidents, and orlistat, that's not great either. Well, they finally come up with something that is a little bit more reasonable. It mimics your gut hormones, fullness hormones. And so this sounds enticing for sure. How does it work? Well, when you eat food, it stretches the stomach, and then it goes into the small intestines. And in the small intestines, you have cells, intestinal cells called L cells, and they are nutrient sensing. They can sense the nutrients, and they can basically sense that you have eaten something and you're full. And so they produce a hormone, a gut hormone called GLP-1, and it communicates with the system. So it communicates with your brain, the hypothalamus, to say you're not hungry anymore. To people have been calling it food noise, that I'm hungry. It slows down. It also signals to the stomach to slow down, and it does stimulate insulin, and it also can regulate glucagon. It can regulate glucagon, and glucagon is the hormone that causes you one of the causes your glucose to rise. So it can kind of put the brakes on that. So it has lots of effects. And for the most part, it's really physiologically, this is how the body communicates when you eat a big meal, a big nutrient-dense meal, then you're going to get these signals. But they figured out that these signals, they do wear off. The body has enzymes that break down the GLP-1. And so in a couple of hours, you're going to feel hungry again, because the GLP-1 that has been released by our body is going to wear off. And so you're going to start to have the food noise come back, and you're going to start having growling of the stomach. So they've figured out a way to make these hormones stick around and be less able to be degraded. And so they have these once a week shots called Ozempic that we're talking about, Ozempic or Mounjaro. And so the thing is, these work. These are highly physiologic. They mimic your own physiology in a good way, and they cause you to lose weight. So this is in percentage of body weight, a change. And in this study, there were 500 in the treatment group, 530, and 270 in the switch to placebo group. So in the orange here, they're both of the people, both groups are on the medicine and they're losing weight. And then at the 20-week mark, they switch a group to having a placebo. And basically, they started to regain weight when they stopped having the chronic fullness hormone being injected into them all the time. And so, this is the problem with the medicine, that if you take this fullness hormone all the time, you at some point, when do you come off? When do you start? What's the exit strategy? Because if you stop, then the medicine is going to start wearing off and you're going to start feeling very hungry and you're just going to start gaining weight again. So, what are the side effects of semaglutide? In this study, the same study that we just mentioned, this the last slide, it affected people's GI system. Some people experienced diarrhea, 14%, then compared to the switch to the placebo group, 7%. Many people complain of nausea. They liken it to a morning sickness type experience. Or just how you feel, how you would feel very bad if you ate overate and you just kind of felt uncomfortable. Sometimes people feel this way, mildly nauseous. Many people complain about constipation because it slows down the stomach emptying and slows down movement of the GI tract. So people are going to get more constipated. Some experience vomiting. So it was so bad, they experienced vomiting and headache, definitely more than placebo. So, who should definitely stay away from Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound, these medicines? If you've ever had pancreatitis, this is an absolute contraindication because it could cause you to have pancreatitis again. And pancreatitis, it's kind of like a three strike, you're out kind of thing. If you keep having it and breaking down of the pancreas, it can be really problematic and sometimes deadly. So, if you've had pancreatitis, please avoid. Another one is gastroparesis. So gastroparesis is where people who have problems with gastric emptying, and hours and hours and hours later, maybe you kind of regurgitate some food that was supposed to be digested hours and hours ago, where basically you have very, very slow movement of the GI tract. Well, long-term GLP-1 medicines will worsen this and slow it down. Thyroid cancer, when studied, as most medicines are studied on animals, there was a concern about causing thyroid cancer in the studies. And so anybody who has thyroid cancer and a theoretical concern would want to avoid it. And because they haven't been studied in type 1 diabetes, it would be off-label to use these medicines on folks with type 1 diabetes. Okay. There are lots of concerns about this medicine, namely what's the exit strategy? But have you heard the saying that what is it? Something like there's nothing that doesn't go, no miracle of science that doesn't go from a blessing to a curse. And in this case, you kind of worry about that. Even though it's kind of ticking all the boxes and being a very physiologic drug and relatively safe. One, it's very costly. And because many people are on it, there are supply issues. Sometimes people will get started on the medicine and then they go to pick it up at the pharmacy and it's just not there because there's no supply. So that's problematic. Also, basically, once you stop the medicine, you'll start to regain weight. We have seen that proven weight gain after coming off. The other thing is that our body has this GLP-1 hormone. We can make it ourselves. And learning how to basically make yourself full but not gain weight is the key to this whole thing. And we talked about this staying under the 600 calories per pound, bulky diets, satisfying bulky diets. That's the key. That's what you want to learn. That's what you want to do. And so by being on this medicine, it could potentially, you could feel full and you could not be learning your hunger triggers and fullness triggers, and basically start to lose touch with your body. And the last thing that I actually really worry about is the idea of a stimulated appetite. So just like with any drug, for coffee, for instance, take coffee, for instance. Coffee is a stimulant and people use it to wake up. Well, if you use it to wake up all the time and you become tolerant to the medicine, eventually people feel sleepy all the time unless they drink coffee. So, in the same instance, if you're taking a medicine that makes you feel full all the time, imagine how hungry you would be like once you come off this sort of chronic fullness stimulate, feeling chronically full. So once you would come off the medicine, the assumption is that you would feel even hungrier, that your appetite would be increased or enhanced. And this is something, of course, that I'm worried about. It's a little bit theoretical, but it happens with most every drug where you have the opposite effect, especially when you're coming off of a medicine. That's what I'm a little worried about. Besides, once again, your body produces your own GLP-1, and that's what these pharmaceutical companies are trying to emulate. This is your own body's GLP-1, and it's nutrient sensing. So what is interesting is that the healthy fats seem to trigger it pretty a little bit stronger than some of the other nutrients, other macros. So things like flax and seeds and the healthy fats that you can get from greens, especially more like wild greens and dandelion and collards and things. And then as well as nuts. I know when you're losing weight, this nuts can be problematic, but that's not the only thing that increases GLP-1. Also, foods that are high in protein for plant-based, we're talking about legumes, beans and greens, also high complex carbs, fiber. The other aspect that's very interesting that we're learning more and more about are the short chain fatty acids that are caused in the colon that break down soluble fibers and they get turned into short chain fatty acids. These are having an effect on GLP-1, increasing GLP-1 and increasing fullness. So there's this short chain fatty acid effect and the fermentable fibers effect from resistant starch. You've heard of the chilled potatoes thing where it increases the starch, resistant starch. It resists digestion in the small intestine, and then once it gets to the colon, it gets broken down by the colonic bacteria. So all of these things increase your GLP-1, and they sound like the same kind of nutrients that you would get from the plant-based diet. So if your A1C is rising, but you're not yet diabetic and you're interested, I can help and I can get you a glucose monitor and I can help you try to sanity check it and avoid the anxiety that you can have from having high spikes. We can kind of go over it together. You could try glucose guided eating, hunger training by having a glucose meter. You can also do it with a point of care, just a test where you could test what your blood sugar is before you're hungry, before you eat, and see if you're under your baseline. So that's one way to do it. And if you're thinking about some of these weight loss drugs like Ozempic or Wegovy, Mounjaro or Zepbound, tighten up your plant-based diet. Remember that your body does its own GLP-1. And what's the exit strategy? What's the exit strategy? Coming off is going to be problematic for you. So we can discuss it. You can have a meeting with me and we can discuss what would be best, what would work best for you. Anyway, I want to say thank you for your attention today. And if you need help, if you need a plant-based doctor, get a doctor who gets you. I can see you online or in person in 16 US states. Here are the states that I am currently licensed and I can be your primary care doctor. I do accept insurance, Aetna, Cigna, TRICARE, and Medicare. And thank you so much for your attention. Till next time, bye bye now.